Brett Bartholomew is Director of Performance at Unbreakable Performance in Los Angeles and Bartholomew Strength Online. In this interview, we discuss what it means to be a conscious coach, as well as Brett's best learnings from experience in the public and private sector around the world. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fun. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Welcome back to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Today we're calling across to California to speak to Brett Bartholomew, Director of Performance at Unbreakable Performance in Los Angeles, and Bartholomew Strength, a consulting company for sports performance around the world. Pretty excited to talk to Brett. We crossed paths briefly at his previous employers of Exos in Phoenix, Arizona. Brett's been around the world, worked with Olympic and professional athletes in, I think, 23 different sports, and Now he's moved into the private sector, and I'm pretty excited to ask Brett about all sorts of different things. So welcome to the show, man.
Appreciate it. Glad to be here.
Now, you've been on a fair few podcasts, so most people should know your story around, but give us a 60-second snippet of who is Brett.
Good. You got the clock going?
I've got it going.
All right. When I was 16, I was hospitalized. That hospitalization manifested itself, or I was hospitalized because of a extreme weight loss due to depression that I had in high school. I had to regain body weight back from about 107 pounds to 156 to reverse some adverse health effects. Once I did that, I would just became more and more enamored with the things that the human body could do. So went on to get my degree in kinesiology from Kansas State University. Later on, got my master's in motor learning with an emphasis on attentional focus from Southern Illinois University, and spent some time in the collegiate setting of strength and conditioning at the University of Nebraska and at Southern Illinois, where I worked in football, basketball, and 8 Olympic sports, and then was with Exos for 6 years, worked with military, a variety of special forces division, high school, youth, gen pop, and then also ran their pro sports side for NFL and UFC programs. And now I'm in LA for Unbreakable Performance, doing about a 1 to 2 year commitment down here from an entrepreneurial standpoint, and a nice little reclamation project to turn this place into a unique culture of performance training itself. So
I'm pretty impressed there. That was 68 seconds, Brett. That's for sure. Very well done. Only issue with that is I've got to say, because Paul Pierce went there, because my uncle works there, Rock Chalk Jayhawk.
No way.
Yep.
No way.
Yep. Long time Kansas fan.
Yeah, they're great. They're great at football. Let me tell you, real dinosaur.
Oh, that's a low blow. So one thing I've been really excited to ask you about is something I think most people get most excited about when they follow your content, especially on Twitter, and in my experience, is being a conscious coach. So what is conscious coaching, and what does it mean to you?
So I think, the idea for me came about, I got pretty tired of a lot of coaches, like kind of just naming themselves as, oh, I'm a speed guy, I'm a strength guy, I'm a power guy, I'm an agility guy, I'm this guy, I'm that guy. It seemed like in the world that we live in, or in this time within our profession, that everybody feels compelled to create some kind of unique niche. But one thing that I've found, at least through my observation, that the majority of great coaches have in common, like really world-class coaches, salt of the earth type folks, is they're very balanced in their perspective. And that to me is a conscious coach. So you hear people talk about mastery and master level coaches. I think that term gets thrown around a lot. I don't think there's ever such a thing in human performance or strength and conditioning as a master coach. Maybe if you're terming that in terms of their age, right? Like a master's level weightlifting competition. I understand that kind of nominative determinism. But what works for one athlete will rarely work for another. So to say that we're masters of something and we've got it down pat when it's all very highly variable, I don't think that exists. I think at best you can be a conscious coach, which means that you have an awareness of all these things that affect both people from a human nature standpoint and performance from just a physicality standpoint. And being able to have a balanced approach in your training, in relational-based communication, in your overall holistic mindset towards physical development is one of the best things that you can really kind of build yourself towards. So in essence, I kind of got tired of all the BS and all the people kind of, you know, kind of saying this or that. And I'm like, okay, let's sit here and we should really be focused on the big picture of what we do, both from a profession standpoint and even within our own careers and our own livelihoods. And that's more of a personal thing, is being in the collegiate setting, especially in the United States. You see a lot of coaches that dive headfirst in this profession. And it's almost as if success is a big kind of taboo thing, right? Like, you're not one of us if you're not working 12-hour days. You're never home. You're spending more time with other people's kids than yourselves. And you're divorced. And by the age of 40 or 50, you can barely lift weights and take care of yourself. So that conscious coaching ideology really goes into just the philosophy of balance that I think is really important. And not having that in my own life really early led me down a dark path. So it's an important mission to me.
Oh, it's a good mission. And I think it's an important mission for our field. I noticed that our field seems to split down kind of a line of where on one side we have kind of your nerds, your certain social, you know, stereotypes, the really book smart people. And then on the other side, the personalities, the really outgoing ones, the ones who look the part and maybe lack some of the other skill sets and each have their flaws and each have their stereotypes. And they're, you know, the really good ones are obviously a combination of the two. But I think you speak really well on what common denominators we need to build in coaches, don't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, to that point, exactly. I've just never gotten this idea why you can't be smart and have a great personality, right? Like, you can't be aware of the data, but also know the appropriate times to use it and the appropriate times to be more focused on the art of what you do, right? Like, there's just this ever swinging pendulum, and it's kind of embarrassing and annoying that our industry hasn't gotten past that, because you talk to a lot of other folks in a lot of different professions and it's just not always that way. You know, I remember one time we were going for a UFC performance summit, and I was fortunate enough to meet, one of the leaders in that organization. And he was not a strength and conditioning coach, right? He helps run a lot of aspects of the UFC. And I remember, you know, I shook his hand. I was like, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And he goes, you know, you have a very interesting profession. And I asked him, I go, well, what do you mean by that? He goes, other than politics, I don't believe I've ever seen a profession where people badmouth one another or try to create this divide quite as much as yours. And that's an outsider and somebody that's a very successful businessman looking at our profession and saying, hey, like, really interesting at the divide you guys take and the way that you approach your profession, career, and relationships within it. And you just kind of think about it. I've seen it my whole time. I mean, in the collegiate setting, you know, I worked under a coach and he's a great guy. But I remember he had the ideology and the philosophy that if you saw somebody online or heard about them online, that there was no way they were a real coach, right? But then you also had your kind of overly blue collar coaches, kind of quote unquote in the trenches every day, that claim to have all these answers yet would never share them. So once again,
or haven't read a journal in decades.
Right. So again, you find that ideology of being a conscious coach, like, why can't we be both? You know, and I found that that was a necessity at Exos. When I started at Exos, it kind of had a reputation, at least in the American football world, of being a bit soft in its training philosophy. A lot of people thought that they had taken the term functional a bit overboard. So, you know, here I was and a number of other coaches in the company as well, doing front squats, deadlifts, resisted sprints, depth jumps, but, you know, just, again, good foundational training. And I realized really quickly that if I wanted this kind of perception to change, that sunlight would be the best disinfectant. So even though I had been pretty anti-social media at one point in time, I started taking pictures and guerrilla-esque videos of what our guys were doing and just putting them out there, right? Like, nothing fancy. Here it is. Oh, without a doubt. And so that started to take effect. And it's just interesting, you know, the divides that take place. And I'm pretty outspoken about it. And I think that it's hard for our profession to move forward until more people just get on the train of pumping one another up and being supportive about it and a little bit more common sense and quit worrying about selling some idea or philosophy as if it's their own and just get on board with being a better coach and person in general.
Oh, I like that concept. And I don't think you can overstate its importance, Brett, because when I think about it, the two things that come to mind, one is my friend Alex Natera tweeted maybe a month or two ago that it's funny when people criticize those who kind of stick with their old ways while dogmatically standing by their just as unsubstantiated new ways. He phrased it differently, but I think you know what I mean. And the other thing is how I think people are very territorial with their niches or with their expertise. And I've even found like, this guy's the best speed coach, or that guy's the best speed coach, or this guy's an expert in that, and that guy's found success with those teams, or that guy doesn't have any gold medals to his name, and this guy does. It's like, there's lots of good coaches out there, and we can all learn from each other.
Right, and let's not forget that we're not neurosurgeons. A lot of the functions of our success are still predicated on the athletes that we come in contact with. There are some very poor coaches out there that have some high or associated with athletes with tremendous accolades, and vice versa. Some of the best coaches that we have yet to ever hear of are coaching people out of their garage, right? Or a very simple type play. And so I think a lot of times we like to brand ourselves as something really special and unique. Like, you know, and the more I study human nature and psychology, which is my primary interest right now, the more you realize that all of this is really a function of deep rooted insecurity and this idea of a friend versus foe, right? Like these things get a little bit too close to home and we don't know how to handle it. So our ego takes control.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. So if there are some young coaches then, Brett, who are, you know, pretty new to these concepts, but they want to be the best coach that they can be and they want to be a conscious coach, what are some ways that young coaches can kind of build this skill set and this awareness?
Coach everybody. Coach everything you can get your hand on. If your girlfriend's got a plant in the apartment, talk to it, right? Like, I think the biggest thing that built it for me is the amount of times I've had to put my foot in my mouth in terms of saying at one point in my career, and typically it was when I first started, I'll never do this. I'll never do that. I don't believe in this. I don't believe in that. Very different when you're staring at a group of 10 to 15 special forces operators and they have shrapnel. They have, they've had surgery on their hip 3 times. They've had shattered vertebrae. They've had all this. When all of a sudden now, you know, me saying, oh, I'm an Olympic weightlifting guy or I'm this and that. Well, now I got some guys that may need to use machines. Now I may need to utilize manual resistance. Now you may need to utilize a variety of things. So, you know, I would attribute, there's this elitism of everybody thinking that pro athletes are the best and the only people to train. And, you know, I don't want to be a hypocrite. The majority of folks I train now are professional athletes, but I also don't turn away other folks, right? I trained like at Exos, anybody that worked for that company was supremely blessed to have the opportunity to work with a substantial amount of youth, gen pop, military, athletes, corporate. I mean, you had to coach. We all had our kind of niches over time, but you had to coach the heck out of whoever came through that door. And somebody's, perspective is shaped by their experience. And I would say let me rephrase that. Somebody's perspective is really shaped by the, variability of the experiences they've had, right? You can have somebody that has coached for 30 years, but only one certain population. And he may not have the knowledge or perspective as a coach that's coached half that amount of time, but coached people from all over, right? Like you mentioned that I had coached athletes from 23 sports. I used to say the only one I had not coached was ping pong. I worked with a ping pong player from India when I was at Exos. And I trained that guy with the same level of fervor and enthusiasm as I train any of my NFL guys. So I think people need, like, the best way for young coaches to understand that is coaching is coaching. Doesn't matter if you're working with a member of the All Blacks or a member of Pee Wee, you know, American football team, or Jimmy and Janie that can't blink and breathe at the same time. If you don't want to be a great coach, then, like, you know, you'll separate the effort that you and the amount of passion that you show both of them. But if you want to be great, you'll go at it because you're going to take so many lessons from that. And they're not things that you can read from a book or a blog or anything like that. It's firsthand experience. So that first and foremost is what I would say, because I certainly don't think, Jake, that information is lacking. That's where I think people are still caught in this information age and not focused enough on the transformation that can come of it. Nobody has any problem accessing information now, but you're still seeing a lot of crappy coaching out there, right? What you're seeing is less people in the trenches and not enough people getting their hands dirty. I mean, like, you look at something I just posted on my Instagram and it's about failure, right? So there's not enough coaches willing to say, you know, I just want to run session after session after session, good ones, bad ones. There's going to be all kinds of sessions, but what matters is that you go back and you take the notes and you learn from those examples. So I just don't think that there's anything that can replace getting your hands dirty and getting right in the thick of it.
Oh, I totally agree with that, Brett. And I think it's almost a cliche that some people think that they understand this, but they don't actually go and act upon it. I've had some funny experiences this year. I actually related this story in my podcast with Jeremy Shepherd, talking about how working with a group of cricketers here has actually been the most educational thing I've done, because those guys were tough. And I had like 2 months where it was just not great compliance, not great vibe in the room. And then they discovered that I like fishing almost as much as they do. And then it clicked. And just being willing to get in there and put myself out there as a personality and try and talk to them rather than coaching like a robot, which some people do. Some people just think that the more they learn from books, the better they're going to become as a coach. And it's just not that simple.
Right. No. Yeah. Spot on. And I think you hit a certain piece there. Now the fishing piece is about relatability, right? And so we know the value of relatability for sure. I think another one that most young coaches are scared to utilize is the concept of vulnerability, being able to, you know, share certain aspects about your personal life or even openly discuss weaknesses that you may have. And so again, people don't really understand that it's okay to think with your mind, but you need to see yourself through the athlete's eyes. And most athletes see us as strength and conditioning coaches or performance professionals as, you know, fairly white bread type individuals, right? Oh, there's this guy that likes lifting and fitness and he's so regimented and he's coaching us on all these habits. Like, what do you got in common with me? And the reality is you need to show a lot of different sides of yourself if you want to enhance relatability, relationships, and adherence. All that is the subject of the book that I'm working on right now. Is I just don't see that done much. People don't want to volunteer information about themselves that makes them look weak or non-validated in some kind of expert type of way. And that's where the gold is. You know, when I work with high school athletes, I try to tell as many dumb jokes as I can. And the kids are like, you're a nerd. But they laugh, you know? And so, I may sit here and be, you know, focused on progressive overload and how much weight they're putting to the bar every week and the numbers in that sense. But I'm also focused on how many times I can get them to laugh, you know? And I think those little things are the crown jewels of great coaching.
So let's talk about that then. Thank you for the brilliant transition there to the next topic, is that, man, teams around the world are just dumping money into analytics and numbers and spending like as little as possible on actual S&C. And obviously they can't directly put money into compliance and adherence. But as we've been talking about, those are factors which probably matter a lot more than, you know, chronic versus acute running load for a week and things like that. You know, dare I say, those things are important, obviously, but, where's the middle ground there and what really matters? And third part of that question, Brett, is how can we work on the compliance and the adherence? How can we instigate it?
Yeah, I think the first question is like, where does the balance lie? I think people need, well, first of all, addressing the problem as it really is, a lot of the tech related spending and all the just fancy science that's getting thrown around. And I would say sometimes it's probably pseudoscience because people have tools that they don't even know how to utilize.
Or they're not reliable tools.
Right. And I mean, listen, with the way it is now, if I were to go back in the team setting, and we use a lot of measurements and a lot of different tools in the private side as much as we can with the budget that we have. But I mean, there's so many different variations that measure the same thing now. Half the people don't even know where to begin. Right. Like I was looking at buying a different timing system the other day, and my old standby used to be just the Brower, right? The one that's used at 9 every 10 studies. And at Exos, we had the Fusion Sport, and now there's Freelap, and now there's this. And so,
yeah, I use a radar gun.
Right. Yeah. And so it's funny because you used to just be able to separate, okay, do you test and measure with some great tools or do you not? Now it's like everybody measures, but it's almost this bourgeois type of comparison of, oh, you have those force plates. Well, we use this. And so-and-so's research showed, well, talk about confirmation bias, right? Like, is all this information really, there's a difference between being smart and being intelligent. And I would say we have a lot of smart folks out there, but the intelligence, it gets dicey when people start having some of these silly arguments. But let's, a spade is a spade. And I think a lot of teams have these things because it's an arm race. And that doesn't really matter what sport you're talking about, whether it's American football or soccer or rugby or NBA, anything like that, basketball. A lot of this is an arms race. And so you have tools and toys and tech that a lot of people just want to say that they have. Or if they have it, they've got to look good to their peers. So they may say, yeah, we have this, but I don't know that they always really utilize them in the most effective manner. And let's be honest, who's to say what the most effective manner is, because that depends on the sport in which you're talking about, the training ages of the people you're working with. There's so much variability when we're trying to limit the variability, right? And so I think that's a big piece. And I'm just a big, I was having this talk with Dave Regan the other day, who works on the sports science side with the Miami Dolphins. And, you know, he just had his head in his hand and he was just like, you know, there's so much that we try to do down here and we feel really good about it, but it's still a war every day trying to get these guys to buy into it. And I think that's the biggest piece is in any team sport, the biggest limiting factor is going to be the individual themselves. And I study history a lot, and you see that anytime there was a new emperor and they needed armies to unite, fight, anything like that, it wasn't about getting them better armor and better swords. It was about helping them unite against a certain cause, right? You had to rally the troops, so to speak. And I was telling a story today. We were talking about Napoleon, who, when he was first exiled from France and he was put on the island and, you know, he had tried killing himself, didn't work, escaped from the island, came back to France, had this ragtag group of soldiers that he couldn't even afford to feed or pay, right? Now, the French sent the Imperial Army to kind of squash this because they heard Napoleon had returned. The armies get ready to face side by side, the Imperial Army and then Napoleon's little ragtag force. Napoleon stepped out in front of his troops and said, "Are you sure you want to kill me? Like, I'm your true emperor. Like, remember everything we've done together. Remember all the conquests, all these things." And one by one, the Imperial Army switched sides, got behind Napoleon, and he marched back into France and became the emperor once again. And my point with that is that you really have to get these people to understand the value in what you're trying to accomplish. You have to establish a concrete message and cause rather than just bring this stuff in and say, "Okay, guys, we're doing this today." I don't think many coaches address the why. And if they do address the why, I don't think they talk about the how, the what, and they really inform these athletes as much as they try telling them what they're going to do. Now, listen, is getting up there and giving some huge speech and motivational thing going to all of a sudden increase adherence? No. Let's face it, you're going to have some athletes that just don't care. You're going to have some organizations that don't support it at the level that they should. But every single thing in this world starts with a behavior change. Behavior change before stress management. They talked about the guinea worm in Africa, this worm that would infect people. And it would cause this immense burning sensation. And this is perhaps the best example of the point I'm going to make. And it would create a burning sensation in the limb or the area of the body in which it was infected. Well, what would happen is people would then run out into the water and jump in the water. Well, at this time, the guinea worm would come out of their skin and hatch millions of larvae getting into the water, thus getting into the drinking supply, the drinking water supply, and infecting more people. So the way that they were able to kind of crush this epidemic, so to speak, is, in their words, they had to stop treating it as a medical issue and start treating it as a behavior issue. They said the number one thing we got to do is make people quit getting in the water. That's the number one cause. So I think, you know, when it comes down to human behavior, and this goes into one of the questions that was talked about on Twitter, like, what's the value of personality profiling? What's the value of understanding people's drives and the root causes of their behavior? Shoot, like, even understanding where they come from, their socioeconomic background, all that. When you do that, and when you have better observations of the people around you and the people that you're leading, it drives better conversations. Better conversations about what you're trying to do and the nature of your cause and how it matters to that individual then drives better adherence. So I think that you've got to get to the root cause of the DNA of the team, or the root DNA of the team, the culture, the environment, what you can do, what you can't do, and then also quit trying to, like, affect everything with this massive scope. People get this budget and they bring in all these tools. Well, shit, use one of them. And once you have one thing going really well, then bring in another one. Treat it like a story, right? Like, if I'm reading a story to my cousin, right, I don't sit there and just bleh, regurgitate like the whole summary in the book. I go page by page. This part of the book leads to that. This character talks to that character. Well, we want to do HRV and Omega Wave and load monitoring and all this. And it's just bleh. Like, imagine if somebody told you, "Hey, Jake, if you go drink from this puddle out there, that's going to enhance this aspect of your performance. And if you eat this leaf, that's going to do that. And if you breathe through your eyes, that's going to do that, right? Some of this stuff either doesn't make sense in general or doesn't make sense in your mind because you have no concept or experience with that kind of either way of thinking or modality or what I'm asking you to do. Well, we're asking these players to do things that they have no concept or knowledge of. They don't understand the foundational underpinnings of any of it. And then we get mad when they don't adhere to something. Like in the NFL, when they were first, you know, doing all the catapult stuff and the heart rate, like you would have guys that wore their heart rate monitor down by their waist. Then you'd be like, hey man, like, can you get that up by your heart? Like it's a heart rate monitor. It's not a belly button monitor. Then they'd say, nah, man, I don't need the front office spying on me. You had players legitimately believing that if they didn't put out and practice, that that data was going to be used against them. And can you blame them? If you're from East St. Louis or a rough area and you're lucky to have made it out of where you were alive, let alone to the highest echelon of your sport, right? And you haven't had a whole lot of people in your corner, I wouldn't blame them. Now you're trying to test me and monitor me and you're telling me what to do every 5 seconds. Piss off, man. Let me play my sport.
Yeah.
So I think they really got to get down to addressing it from a behavioral standpoint and realizing that we can't use a gavage-based philosophy to just stuff this stuff down our athletes' throats, and you got to take it a little bit more simplistically. But strength and conditioning coaches don't do simplicity well much in the technological age that we live in.
This is very true. This is very true. And, well, it's easy for me to bitch because I can't code R. I'm not a GPS genius. I just find that it's interesting that teams would rather hire someone who can code R or, you know, be a smart-a-base wizard rather than someone who can get adherence and compliance from all their athletes, or rather than someone who can get a room full of 50 people he's never met to do their goddamn foam rolling, you know?
Yeah. What happened? Yeah, think about it, you know, from a survival standpoint. If the lights go out and the power grids fail and all this, what type of people do you want to be around? Right? The ones that can do the most practical things, right? The most essential practical things. But, you know, we don't really always take that into our profession. Practicality is always going to beat anything else. The most cutting edge tool is great coaching. And that's not, listen, like I'm not against the science, right? Like I'm a nerd as well. I love it. But I just think like it's all too much information, too many courses, too much this, too much that. Like everybody just wants to sell something as if there's an esoteric secret and there's some missing link. Nothing any of us come up with is new. And I'm not saying quit using it, quit searching it. I'm saying maybe revamp the way in which you address it or frame it up, or maybe cut back on some of the things you do. Shit, maybe ask some of your athletes what they've actually enjoyed about certain things that you're doing and what they don't enjoy about other things, right? Like get feedback from them, honest feedback, and try to work from there. You know, go back to the storyboard.
Well, I think that's really important, especially the athlete feedback, Brad. I've found, especially in the last year, I've realized that and as more and more people begin asking me, like, what do you think about this method? What do you think about that method? Like, I have no idea what works or what doesn't. And I don't think we have much of an idea in this field. And I think anyone who says that they have a good idea, I'm not going to say they're full of crap, but they're on less steady ground than they think they are. And so I guess with that in mind, and we have talked about what a lot of your philosophies are, Brett, but I want to ask you, in a world where even the things which we are most sure about from the scientific literature are very shaky, how can coaches build their philosophies on training?
I think it goes back, and not to be redundant, but just to be truthful, the only way you build a philosophy on anything is, you know, with the experience and getting your hands dirty, right? The best craftsmen are people that have built a lot of tables and a lot of chairs and smoothed a lot of edges. You know, again, like we've got to go back to this apprentice type mentality. People, I always think of the, you know, the individual working in the foundry or the blacksmith shop, just taking the hammer to the sword again and again and again and again, right? Like be a craftsman, quit trying to be, you know, this rocket scientist, you know, that just revels in randomness and everything else. And you've just got to get out there. And the best way to create your philosophy is interact with all kinds of people. I'll tell you, Jake, the most beneficial thing that I used to make my volunteers and interns do had little to do with actual coaching, right? Of course, they do their coaching during the day, but I'd give them homework. And I said, you have to start a conversation with 10 different strangers, right? 10 strangers, and it has to be in 10 different environments. So at the park, at a bar, in a library, at a restaurant, you know, 10 different environments. And the goal, the only goal you have is to keep that conversation going as long as you can. And I would have them then write down, I didn't want them to have an outcome, right? They didn't have to get a woman's phone number. They didn't have to try to network a new job opportunity. They had to just, the outcome was the conversation and the dialogue. And them being able to, first of all, let's stop there. I think even now that's such a foreign subject to people. People don't interact now unless it's got some, well, what can this do for me? You know what I mean? Do you know so-and-so with this team? Yeah, yeah, here's my card, you know? But it was so valuable for them because it taught them how to interact with so many different personality types and how to really listen and reflectively listen and how to do all these things that are so critical to being a great coach and a great person as well. So I think the only way you form your philosophy is to really dive into a bunch of really diverse experiences. And listen, I eat my own cooking. As Nicholas Nassim Taleb says, I'm in LA and I work in Hollywood. This is the only place other than Beijing and Siberia that I never wanted to live in my life. Ever. Like, I'm not an L alien. I'm not a Hollywood guy. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm about as simple as it gets. Like, people think I'm crazy because I don't want to go out every night here. I don't know who half of these celebrities are, nor do I care. I just, you know what I mean? And so, but the reality is it was a time in my life where I wanted to take a risk and my wife did as well. And we said, hey, for 1 or 2 years, let's go do this. Because again, my philosophy is easy to craft when I'm at places like the University of Nebraska or Southern, these team settings, or Exos, this highly organized training system that's evolved since 1999. But I came in here and my facility is in the second story of a Mexican restaurant. I'm a co-owner with 4 other people, Brian Urlacher, Jay Glazer, Lindsay Berg. All of us have, I haven't met Brian, but all of us have different philosophies and visions and personalities and all this. And when I came in, there was no screening system. There wasn't even a defibrillator present when we showed up here. So I'm sitting here having to tell the staff, like, one, they're like, what's the first thing we do? And I go, get a defibrillator, you know, and there was no training template. There was no nothing. So I sat there for a minute, and this is important. And I thought, you know, I could just take a lot of the things that I've been doing other places and put them in here, right? And then I thought about it. And I'm like, no, this isn't the same kind of environment. You know, we get a wildly different demographic in here. And so it made me rethink what I was doing and say, what's worked in the past? What could I make better? Or more importantly, how can I make it reflective of what I have here? So I think that's the other thing where people can craft their philosophy is, one, get your hands dirty, like we already talked about. 2, diverse experiences. And then 3, start like with a blank slate wherever you go. Don't think that just because this questionnaire and the way that you formatted it with the team you were with in the past is the best way. You're going to have a wildly different subset of athletes maybe, per, you know, at your next place. You're going to be in a different geographical location, right? And we talk about how gestures and the way in which we speak can change from geographic region to region. Well, so should our practices. So should the way that we frame things up. So I think those 3 things are, and like, really help you become adaptable and form a philosophy that isn't as rooted in bias as maybe some are that just do a lot of reading and don't get outside their comfort zone much.
Mm. That is a pretty good batch of advice there, Brett. And I think, yeah, I think a lot of that stuff, like, that's going to fall in the category of stuff that people won't understand it until they understand it. Because what didn't you say there is sets and reps and exercise selection. And I think the older we get, the more we realize, dare I say, how little that actually matters.
Oh, and it's true. And that's usually when you know, Jake, you've met an experienced coach, is they don't get defensive about hearing that. Like, I would say program design was the number one thing, and still is, that I was most passionate about in throughout my 20s. Like, I was obsessive, and like, I'd study everything from Juan Carlos Santana to, you know, West Side to Fergushansky to just, I mean, anybody, Tudor Bompa, you know, Stephen Plisk, Mike Stone, anything you could get your hands on. It's like more, more, more. And then you realize this is not what, like, this different recipe and this tweak here is not going to win my guys a Super Bowl. Now, listen, a strength coach can lose people a game or a match or what have you. A bad strength coach can. But when working with teams, our role is much fuzzier than it is when working with individuals, right? I work with a lot of fighters. Even that, even in the MMA realm or boxing realm, my role is relatively fuzzy because it still is highly predicated on the emotional state of that athlete. Success is predicated on the emotional state of that athlete, the level of their technical, tactical preparation specific to their sport going into it, right? Everything like that. In comparison to working with like a shot putter, right? Or a track and field athlete, where it's a little bit more, there's a little bit more of a narrow gap, right? There are some things that are a little bit more clear. In American football, our role is probably the most fuzzy. I can have a guy that's an absolute stud. Shoot, I could have three guys on a team that are absolute studs. But what's the game plan? Who's our opponent? What's the field conditions? So that's where I think coaches, the most important thing they can do is take a step back and realize that you're very important as a strength and conditioning coach, but you're far from the most important person in the room. And it's okay. That's okay. That doesn't mean that like our job's worthless. We have a high value job. But the number one thing that transfers, and there are other coaches that say this, is the confidence from great training. The confidence. But that really bugs people because they're like, well, how can we objectively measure confidence? Then I've had somebody to, you know, I said one time on Twitter, you know, people need to train with intent. I was talking about training. Well, how do we measure intent? Some shit you don't have to measure. Right? Like if I see somebody getting after it, that's intent. You know what I mean?
You get an example of that quickly. So my PhD has been around speed, and we did a speed training intervention with the New Zealand women's sevens team building up to the Rio Olympics. And a lot of people were asking, you know, what's the one thing that's going to tell you that you've made them faster and that you've made them fast enough? I said, when they get the ball in open space and they've got a defender to beat and they back themselves and they go and try and beat that defender.
Yeah.
Yeah, people want to punch me when I say that.
No, and you know what? I just think people want to punch you because they want to overcomplicate. And it's like, by again, this idea of being smart is different than being intelligent, where it's just kind of like in the past, right? Like if there was a lightning storm, oh, the gods are angry. You know, the gods are angry, or like this star is, you know, somebody watching over me in the heavens. Like we have to relate some kind of cause or other meaning to everything we do. I know the guy's fast because he caught the pass at the 10-yard line and beat every damn defender on there. I know this person is working hard because I see the strain he's putting into each rep, right? And so, again, I'm not somebody that's anti-measurement. I'm just like, be practical with it, right? Like, we use a Nord board here. We use a jump mat. We use different screening procedures. We use a lot of different things, whatever we can, and we have like zero budget. That's the fun of it. Is you have to get creative with everything you do. And somebody's like, well, how do you know your athletes are getting stronger? Oh, you know, well, I have them, they have a training journal and they have a card and they fill that out every week. And I see their weights go up every week. And that means they're getting stronger, you know? And they're like, well, how do you know they're moving the bar fast enough? Well, we use push. Okay. Well, you know, push doesn't have the same level of validity as gym aware. Okay, well, we can't afford a gym aware, so we use push, so it works well for us. Yeah, thank you.
Why don't you give us a staff who can monitor the gym aware, you know?
Yeah, yeah, it's just like, and like what I ask people now sometimes if they do say that is, I'm like, what's the real thing you're getting at here? Like, what do you want to know? You know, because if what you're saying is that the world's best, the best of the best, need all these things to succeed, you need to study your sporting history a bit more.
Or go watch Fiji rugby, who just won the Olympics. And I'm not entirely sure, pardon me if they do, not entirely sure that they have a strength coach. I think Ben Ryan just programmed all
right. And people can't get it through their head that, again, strength and conditioning is a piece of it. We're a part of it. To act as if what we're doing is going to completely change the course of sports is just not the case. Our DNA is always going to be the most limiting factor. And granted, we can affect DNA expression and signaling and all these kinds of things. That's great. But you're still not going to be the sole one responsible for taking these athletes to that level. At best, what we do, we help manage. Again, right? Like we alter behavior and manage stress. But again, the first thing for me is always behavior. If I want somebody, think in what aspect of life does a result come to fruition that is not dependent on behavior, right? Like if you have a girlfriend or a wife, you had to get somebody to like you. If you had a job, you had to get somebody to believe in you. If you have anything, like everything starts with some kind of level of behavior or psychosocial interaction. Why is what we do any different? But it's easier to grab. We're a culture that likes our stuff, and we're a microwave culture. So our stuff is always going to answer these things for us, other than our skills, apparently.
That was a good point at the end there as well, Brett. All right, got two more rapid fire questions for you, and then we're out of time. In three sentences, what are the three factors or three common denominators that you have seen among all great strength coaches?
Yeah, I think I'll disappoint you. It's one sentence. I just think their ability to balance, right? Everything from the performance standpoint, their ability to relate to others, and their ability to synthesize and simplify information.
Last one. I am a fellow history nerd, so I'm going to ask you, which historical character would you most like to go back in time and have a beer with? For me, it's Alexander the Great, hands down.
Really? Why? I'm going to ask you, why Alexander the Great?
I think he's the most extraordinary human in recorded history. I think he's had more downstream impact on Western civilization than anyone else who's ever lived. And I know Genghis Khan is probably close. Yeah, for me, he just went and saw and did a lot of different stuff.
I think it was interesting because Alexander the Great, like in side note, right, you look at somebody that I think he was like the cavalry commander by like 18. Man, he had conquered what, most of the known world by like, was it 22 or 24, something around that range?
Yeah.
But again, the cautionary tale for strength coaches that can't quit with their quest of never-ending information. His biggest failure was that he couldn't, he had this obsessive compulsive desire that he never stopped. He never stopped. And so one of his biggest attributes became one of the biggest parts of his downfall, you know, and that's what's interesting about him. But yeah, no, definitely think that'd be phenomenal. For me, it would be Ben Franklin, because that was an individual that, again, when I think of intelligence, he had it. He had the intelligence of an inventor, but he was a folksy figure and related extremely well to everybody. And one of my favorite stories, and I talk about it in a certain presentation I give called The Impact of Influence, is when America was trying to win the Revolutionary War, they needed to gain favor from the French king in order to get funding to do so. Do you know the story? Should I stop?
No, tell it, because I love this story.
Okay, so, you know, he went over to France and, you know, they hadn't heard from him in a while. So John Adams went over there and to check on him, because he's like, what's this guy doing? And obviously, because we were in a pretty dire situation. And he found Ben Franklin running around and gallivanting with aristocratic society, you know, wearing a coonskin hat out in public and drinking and staying out late at the salons and just hobnobbing with everybody. And John Adams was just getting pissed. And I'm sorry if you don't, you know, if I can't use those terms on here, but John Adams was just livid. And he goes, how is the man that says early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise running around with these prostitutes and these folks and doing all this? And so the rest of America heard about it and they're like, what is our guy doing deserting us? Like, he's a traitor. He left us. And so everybody's, you know, pissed, and they're just talking about all these things that he's done wrong. And in reality, they had no idea that what Franklin was doing over there was adapting to their culture and showing the French the American embodiment of French culture, saying, hey, we can be like you too. Like, see how I relate to you and I get along with you. And what they miss is the aristocratic society loved him. The king loved him. So while John Adams is there at 7 or 8 in the morning, John Adams didn't have the social and emotional intelligence to realize that that wasn't the French way of doing things. The French stayed out late, and most of the business related discussion was done in the evenings, right? Over drinks and things like that. So anyway, he goes back and everybody's livid at Ben Franklin. And eventually Ben Franklin comes back with, you know, bag full of money to oversimplify and says, who wants to win a war? And people were just like, what in the world? So Ben Franklin had the ability. I'm sorry.
And he had the French Navy behind him.
He had the French Navy behind him, and he had the ability to get outside of himself and empathize. So really, that's what I think of when I think of true intelligence. Now, people can talk about the relationship that he had with his wife and, you know, he's a womanizer and all that. But again, yeah, everybody's got their downfall. But I mean, an inventor and somebody that could relate and sympathize, that to me is the kind of coach that I always want to be. And not only that, but the type of person that I think you derive the most benefit associating with, because you know, getting outside yourself is not an easy thing to do. And that provides a lot of value in your work and your life.
That is a darn good story to finish on. Brett Bartholomew of Unbreakable Performance and Bartholomew Strength, thank you for your time today.
Appreciate it, Jake.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Check back next week for episodes from Ryan Horn, Mark Manson, and a few more. If you leave a review of this podcast on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.